Most things in life are what they seem. A bird is a bird, a spade is a spade, and that typically follows suit in medicine. Acute coronary syndrome? Well, that's a severe heart event. Pulmonary embolus? A blood clot in the lungs. But when it comes to the kidney, it's never that simple. Hyponatremia, with hypo meaning low and Na indicating sodium, well, it means low sodium. But is low sodium a salt problem? Today, our patient has hyponatremia, and you are the doctor. Welcome to The Internet Work, a podcast written by medical residents meant to serve you better on the wards and on call. Today's episode is titled, It's a Water Problem, an Approach to Hyponatremia. Time for our minute physiology. Sodium is the major serum osmol and a critical determinant of fluid balance. Where sodium goes, water flows. The kidneys normally tightly regulate serum sodium levels and thereby overall fluid balance in response to signals from the heart about blood volume, i.e. ANP and BNP, signals from the brain osmoreceptors about osmolality, ADH, and signals from the renin-angiotensin system about blood pressure, aldosterone. Hyponatremia indicates that there is an excess of water relative to the sodium in the serum, and this is often due to a failure in one or more of these signaling pathways. In hyponatremia, water shifts out of the serum and into cells in an attempt to restore normal serum osmolality. This can cause dangerous brain swelling, particularly when sodium levels are severely low and large amounts of water shift into brain tissue. All that to say, hyponatremia is rarely a reflection of low volume of salt or sodium in the blood, but rather a mismatch of water to sodium concentration. Remember the concept of dilution from chemistry class. Let's talk about our approach. Hyponatremia is defined as a serum sodium of less than 135 millimoles per liter. The first step in assessing a patient with hyponatremia is to make note of the severity of hyponatremia and to assess whether the patient is experiencing severe symptoms of hyponatremia, which are typically neurologic manifestations such as seizure or coma. If severe symptoms are present, they require immediate doses of hypertonic saline and management of ABCs. Otherwise, the clinical approach should focus on identifying the etiology and the chronicity of the hyponatremia, which will guide treatment. The first step in the workup of hyponatremia in a non-seizing patient is looking at the serum osmolality. You expect to see a low serum osmolality, less than 275 millimoles per liter, because sodium is usually the major serum osmol and it is low, so your total osmols are low. If you have a normal or high serum osmolality, this can mean that other osmols are present at high concentrations, like glucose or mannitol, and sodium concentration has dropped to maintain normal osmolality. In many cases, you may not have a serum osmolality available, but what you really need to think about in this first step is whether the hyponatremia is attributable to excess hyperglycemia or receipt of mannitol. If the osmolality is normal, protein levels and triglycerides should be tested, as elevated levels can interfere with the assay, causing a laboratory error that makes the sodium falsely appear low. Direct sodium measurement with a blood gas analyzer can remedy this lab error. The next step is to think about why they may have hyponatremia. Recall that hyponatremia reflects a relative excess of water. This can be due to too much free water intake, too little free water excretion, or loss of salt in excess of free water. Determining the reason why your patient has hyponatremia is helpful in guiding their overall clinical management. While in the past, volume status has traditionally been the next step in determining the etiology of hyponatremia, recently, there has been a shift to categorize hyponatremia as ADH-dependent and ADH-independent. Thus, urine studies such as urine osmol and urine sodium are the most important test in evaluation of hyponatremia. As you will see, the patient's volume status, history, and medication review remain important factors that will help decipher the etiology, especially as urine studies can be identical for different etiologies. Before getting to different clinical scenarios, let's first talk about the interpretation of urine studies. As we said, urine osmolality is our indicator of ADH activity. When the urine osmol is greater than 200, we tend to think of ADH as on, meaning the nephron absorbs more free water. And when less than 200, ADH is off, meaning either there is too much water intake or not enough solute to remove free water. Urine sodium, on the other hand, is indicative of RAS activity, which is our way of figuring out effective circulating volume. Less than 20 is typically indicative of a low effective circulating volume state, where the body is trying to hold on to as much sodium as possible, whereas greater than 40 means that your circulating volume is intact. Now, there are several scenarios where you can see high ADH levels, and this is where history and volume status come into play. Excessive losses of solutes in water, for example in vomiting, diarrhea, and excessive diuresis, burns, or third spacing fluid losses, are common reasons for admission, and the patient might have clinical signs of hypovolemia, including hypotension and tachycardia worsened with orthostasis, flat JVP, and dry mucous membranes. This would be hypovolemic hyponatremia, which will improve with administration of isotonic fluids like Ringer's lactate or normal saline, and a successful trial of fluids can help confirm this etiology. A second common presentation of a high ADH state is hypervolemic hyponatremia, as is seen in patients who are volume overloaded from heart failure, cirrhosis, nephrotic syndrome, or end-stage kidney disease. The patient might have a known history of these conditions, and acute volume overload may have been precipitated by above-target dietary sodium or water intake, inadequate fluid excretion due to acute kidney injury, suboptimal diuretic dosing, and/or suboptimal ultrafiltration in dialysis patients. In patients with hypervolemia and hyponatremia, it is important to ask about weight gain and quantify this if possible, medication changes or missed doses, eating and drinking habits. It is important to note that patients already on diuretics with a history of these conditions can have hypovolemic hyponatremia, so properly assessing volume status is critical before deciding on diuresis versus giving fluids. POCUS can be used to assess JVP, IVC collapsibility, and other surrogates of right heart pressures to determine if a patient is hyper or hypovolemic. It should be noted that, whether it is from ineffective diuresis or overdiuresis, hyponatremia in these patient populations often reflects difficult-to-manage heart failure and cirrhosis and carries a poor prognosis in this setting. In the scenarios we've just discussed, hypovolemic hyponatremia and hypervolemic hyponatremia, we see an elevated urine osmol and a low urine sodium less than 20. An exception is in patients who have recently received diuretics. Depending on how long it's been since the diuretic was administered, the urine sodium might be high because the diuretics work by increasing urine sodium. As you can see, both these scenarios would have similar laboratory findings, but it's the history and physical that really help differentiate. The other common ADH on state is SIADH. Normally in hyponatremia, the brain detects low osmolality and lowers production of ADH to limit kidney-free water absorption. However, there exist clinical scenarios where you have inappropriate elevated production of ADH, SIADH, leading to free water reabsorption and hyponatremia. Typically, the patient will be relatively euvolemic and have high urine sodium greater than or equal to 40 milliequivalents per liter and high urine osmolality greater than 300 milliosmoles per kilo, because free water is being reabsorbed due to the high ADH and the urine becomes more concentrated. Causes of SIADH include CNS disturbances like stroke, brain hemorrhage, and other trauma that enhance ADH release, malignancies, particularly small cell lung cancer with ectopic release of ADH, other pulmonary diseases like pneumonia and respiratory failure through unclear mechanisms, stressors like pain, fear, and surgery due to limbic system activation and increased release of ADH, drugs including MDMA, carbamazepine, high-dose IV cyclophosphamide, SSRIs, and of course vasopressin or desmopressin. You can also see inappropriate ADH release in adrenal insufficiency and hypothyroidism. If the clinical picture and urine studies are suggestive of SIADH, you'll want to probe for these many possible causes on history and order investigations as warranted. Finally, cases where the urine is maximally dilute, or an ADH off state, should raise suspicion for massive free water intake, such as in beer potomania or psychogenic polydipsia. It can also demonstrate low solute intake, which inhibits the kidney's ability to excrete free water. What about our workup? Investigations in all patients with hyponatremia should include serum osmolality to confirm hypoosmotic state, urine sodium and osmolality, if high, suspect SIADH or recent diuretic use, glucose to look for hyperglycemia, and creatinine and urea to assess kidney function. Other workup will depend on the suspected underlying etiology. For example, an echocardiogram is warranted in new suspected heart failure, AM cortisol and TSH, as well as possibly a chest x-ray to screen for small cell lung cancer, are warranted in suspected SIADH with no history of CNS trauma. Okay, let's talk about the treatment. Severe hyponatremia with seizures or coma warrants urgent hypertonic saline administration irrespective of etiology. Given in 50 to 100 ml boluses over 10 minutes times 3 PRN until neurologic status improves. Otherwise, treatment of hyponatremia depends on severity, chronicity, and etiology. For hypovolemic hyponatremia, the treatment is IV isotonic fluids. For hyponatremia in heart failure and other edematous states, diuretic therapy is warranted. In heart failure, typically a loop diuretic like furosemide is initiated first and titrated to maximally tolerated doses as required. And then a thiazide-type diuretic like metolazone or hydrochlorothiazide may be added. Care should be taken when starting a thiazide-type diuretic in patients with hyponatremia because this can worsen hyponatremia due to excess urine sodium loss. In cirrhosis, increasing effective circulating volume and perfusing the kidney is the mainstay of treatment, by adding diuretics such as spironolactone and furosemide at a 5-to-2 ratio to maintain potassium equilibrium. However, be mindful that diuretics may worsen hyponatremia in patients with cirrhosis. In short, serum sodium levels must be monitored when stepping up diuretic therapy, especially in patients who are hyponatremic to begin with. For SIADH, we treat the underlying cause if possible, and introduce fluid restriction, typically less than 1 to 1.5 liters per day, until the hyponatremia is corrected. In cases where the underlying cause is difficult to treat or fluid restriction does not correct the hyponatremia, we may consider solute supplementation, for example, hypertonic saline, urea powder, or start a Vaptan medication that blocks ADH signaling in the kidney, for example, tolvaptan. Nephrology consult is typically warranted for these cases. We'll finish with our medicine minute. You'll notice we haven't talked about rates of correction, as they've been an issue of hot debate in the last year. The classic dogma is to avoid overcorrection, rises of serum sodium greater than 6 to 8 milliequivalents per 24 hours, to prevent the development of osmotic demyelination syndrome, where there's demyelination of white matter tracts in the pontine region of the brain from rapid shifts of free water out of these brain regions. Symptoms of ODS usually occur greater than 1 week after sodium overcorrection, and can include upper motor neuron findings, pseudobulbar palsy, and locked-in syndrome. However, newer studies have challenged the classic notion that a rate limit is needed. We dive into this in the Ask a Fellow episode that'll be released later this week alongside this, which we've prepared in partnership with the Neph Madness Executive Committee. We've linked the articles we discuss in that episode, along with the infographic at www.theinternetwork.com. We'll leave it there for today. Thank you for listening to today's episode entitled It's a Water Problem, An Approach to Hyponatremia. This episode was written by Dr. Caitlin Blashart, internal medicine resident, and reviewed by Dr. Jeffrey Cott, intensivist and nephrology fellow, and Dr. Leah Karyanopoulos, internist and intensivist. The Internet Work series was created by Allison Lai and is executively managed by Leah Karyanopoulos and Zara Morale. This episode was recorded and produced by Leah Karyanopoulos. Theme music by Lakshmi Basanthamoa. As mentioned earlier, don't forget to tune in later this week when we release our Ask a Fellow episode in conjunction with the Neph Madness Committee. As always, don't forget to visit www.theinternetwork.com for associated resources and infographics. Thank you for listening, and we hope to see you again soon.